I just got the survey
Hello,
in the mail today.
Hello, is that Tim Martin?
Yes, Martin.
Hello, is that...
Can he hear us?
Can you hear us, Martin?
Yeah. Yes,
oh,
I
good.
Can hear you. Kevin?
Yep, I can hear you, Martin.
Right. Set to go then.
Anyone else there?
Is anyone else there at the stage? Doesn't sound like it.
Not yet.
Well, I'll welcome you all in, so I'll just start on. I shall mute all the guests first, and we'll start. Hello. I'd like to welcome everyone online today. First of the Talk the Walk call, which will introduce Hugo Dizler and Martin Stapper and Kevin Hughes. We welcome all of you, and I'll pass the phone over now to Hugo.
Oh, hello, Martin. Hello, Kevin.
Hi,
how
are
you two?
Hugo.
Good.
Martin, I'd just like to introduce you very, very briefly and give you an opportunity to introduce yourself in that you were a CSIRO scientist in Australia working with cereal crops mainly on a biological, looking at how cereal crops performed in a biological way. Would you like to introduce yourself as to how would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Well, I'm a research scientist, and I'm searching for the truth of our production systems, food production. And I've always been at the forefront of thinking and creating new things and being resource efficient. And of course, that automatically led to the biological farming, to make use of the biology in the soil. That the soil is the limiting factor in our production systems, and in our current farming, it's minimized. It's made like a hydroponics, which doesn't support plant growth. So that's the direction I come from.
And, Martin, you're a friend of Kevin Hughes, so would you like to introduce Kevin, or Kevin would like to introduce himself, or and Kevin's farming at Gippsland in Australia, which is a fairly high rainfall area, or fairly reliable rainfall area. And Martin, would you like to introduce Hugh and your relationship
Yes, thanks, Hugo. I do it with pleasure because we come from the same direction, like questioning our job, how we do our job in a way to be efficient. And Kevin, as a dairy farmer, came to the same conclusions as I did as a scientist, that our current systems are not working. So I leave it up to Kevin to explain his road in life. Kevin?
Thanks, Martin. That's simply and accurately put. As a dairy farmer, we were pushing for high productivity and following what was best practice. We thought with an NPK regime to boost soil fertility and grass growth, and we ran into a lot of problems with animal health and with soil compacting and plants being shallow rooted and becoming weed infested in pastures, and that led me to explore a lot of alternative options that we might pursue, and we experimented with a lot of them over the 20 or nearly 30 years that we were dairying. And the best system we came to work with was to use the Albrecht type balance to get the soil structure and balance, particularly the calcium and magnesium, and to introduce biology that would better utilise the organic nutrients and natural inputs that we had available to actually create a much more balanced cycle within the system. And so we went from there to beef production, and then from there to consulting work.
Kevin, you've been farming all your life, haven't you?
Yes. Yes, 40. I started in 1961.
Right. So you've seen a few changes, really, from as you explained to us, that you saw how your father did things, and then you went into high production farming, and could you explain a very brief history of what sort of farming you into, and what had you changed to the current way of farming?
Well, you're right. When I did my apprenticeship, if you like, with Dad, who was an old-fashioned farmer, I realised that as I progressed into higher inputs of fertiliser and stuff, that we were losing a lot of natural soil fertility and depth. A lot of young farmers starting out today don't realise that that's already been lost in the soils they're starting to work with. So, you know, I was lucky in that sense. So I knew what I wanted to get back to. And, we maintained productivity by cutting back on the potash in particular, created a lot of problems for us with animal health. And we introduced mulching and aerating into the system to try and combat all that sort of thing. But what we continually were coming back to was we needed to reintroduce the old humifying type biology into the system, and we saw that working brilliantly in other areas with the biodynamic processes, but in our area where other farmers were experimenting with that, it wasn't working quite so well, so we had to sort of look further than that. And that's where we're at today, really.
So you saw that there was a need to change. What actual steps did you put into place that had you change? And maybe before we go into that, Martin might explain to us listeners what is actually biological farming. We all know about it, but how would you describe biological farming to people who that term might be new to them?
Yeah, biological farming is farming to create and maintain biological activity in the soil. Because it's the soil organisms that feed the plant, and soil organisms feed the plant in balance. The plant asks for things and the soil organisms give it to the plant. We have changed that over the last 5 decades into the man-driven farming, where we provide everything from the bag and from the drum to feed the plant, to protect the plant. So the plant, in biological farming, the plant is fed by the soil, and the soil protects and feeds the plant in balance.
Now, Kevin, you must have seen some advances in biological farming or changing direction. What steps did you actually take to... where did you get your awareness, and what actual steps did you take to start the process? Because not many... That's one thing what farmers want to really know. How do they actually start the process of the change?
Well, the biggest thing that happened for me was it came to a turning point where I realised I had to change or I wasn't going to continue what I was doing. So you've got to get to the point where you're actually determined to make a change and not just stay with what you can see is not working as well as you want it to work. So in talking with other farmers, I see that's a really important step to get to, yet because change always involves taking risks and doing things that you're not used to doing and that you don't quite understand how they're going to work out with when you start. So you have to have this determination to actually get out on a different track. So that's number one. And the next thing, when I made my mind up about that, the next thing is to go and talk to people that are already doing it. That's what I found was the best thing to do. And then you can see what's working for them and what isn't. And as you try things for yourself, I think an important part of that is to actually share what's working for you and what isn't, so that you can save a lot of stuff-ups in that regard. And you also keep pursuing what is going to work and what's going to work better. So the process for me was the first step. I discovered the Albrecht balance of the cations in the soil, and so that was really the starting point. starting to use more calcium and get the soil more aerated and use more soil and plant-friendly fertilisers, like we've tried animal manures and things like that. And that led us to realising, well, in a degraded soil, there isn't always the biology there that can utilise those inputs effectively, so we have to look at how best to reintroduce that biology. And looking at what other farmers were doing in that regard led us to, well, reject the biodynamic approach because we knew on our clay soils it was going to be a very slow result. And we kept looking, we found a commercial version of the biodynamic microbes that did work.
And what is that commercial product that you use?
Well, it's supplied by the Petric company, and they were just in the process of looking for the same sort of answers as we were looking for, and they took the biodynamic cultures and put them through a commercial vat sort of an incubation process, and the end result is a more robust culture that will work under more adverse conditions. And you said that
it works considerably faster than, it's an proven way of getting the biological process going faster in the soil. Would that be right?
That's my experience with it, yes. Yes, definitely. Probably in some soils that are naturally and not degraded, the BD actually might work as well. But, you know, we're talking with a fairly hostile environment, otherwise you would still have the natural biology there. So in a compacted soil that you want to get productive more quickly.
Yep. And you've lifted the productivity of your place dramatically. By what percentage would you say you've lifted productivity on the main farm?
Oh, 50 to 80%, I would say. And like, that's really a bit hard to quantify. On a client's property, over a 5-year period, we lifted it by 80%. So,
well, when you look at 50 or 80%, that to me, I look at it, that I put it into simple, understandable terms. That would be like buying another 50 or 80% extra acreage, and yet you're well ahead because you haven't got the infrastructure for that extra 50 or 80% acreage. You haven't got the watering points. You haven't got the interest payments. You haven't got all the expenses. So would you see it that way too?
Well, partly that way, because like, to lift it 80% on the given area that you're on, and you have to have high levels of management skills, and it does involve a bit more risk because like, that guy went from a cow an acre to nearly a cow and a bit an acre, so it increased his stocking rate. But he had the management skills and all that sort of thing to actually back that up. So it's not quite as simple as that, but it's definitely along those lines, yeah.
Right.
Well, if you look, for example, just to follow that through a little bit, some people in a given area would be at 50% of the stocking rate of other better managers. And they're not going to increase their stocking rate because they perceive some of these better managers have these problems that we were dealing with. That was our approach. We doubled our stocking rate initially from what Dad used to have, and that's what created the problems. But by restoring the biology, we were able to keep that stocking rate and resolve the problem so that we still had healthy animals and a healthy soil.
But there must be, well, obviously a side benefits to having a healthy animals and healthy soil. In other words, you'd farm with be easier way to farm, wouldn't it?
Well, certainly a much more pleasurable way to farm, and like, that's what I wanted out of agriculture. I wanted it to be a pleasure to be a farmer, not to be a hassle. And that was certainly correct. The quality of the actual experience is hugely enhanced because, you know, suddenly you haven't got all these animal issues that are confronting you, and, you know, it's just a different approach altogether.
Yeah. And with the Petric product, I take it it's in a liquid form, is it?
Well, it's in a liquid or a powder form. The liquid is easier to use because the dry powder you have to brew it up for a certain, like 48 hours, I think it is, and then spray it out within about 3 days of that. 96 hours, I think, might be the time frame. So it's more mucking about. The liquid is more stable. It's in the drum, got a shelf life of several years, so you know it's much.
And you, you
choose from.
Kevin, you mix a few of the Petrick products together, don't you?
Yes. Well.
How many litres to the hectare do you put out, and how many litres of water do you put out, and what sort of jets would you require?
Oh, well, this is for pastures. We use 2 litres a hectare of what we call the evergreen microbes, and that's the cheapest form of the microbes. And they go out in about 100 litres of water a hectare, and we add 1 litre of digested seaweed and a few other additives to add support material to those microbes to help them get established in the soil. So that's 3 litres altogether. And the cost of that is about $47 to $50 a hectare. And that would be an annual treatment for at least the first 3 years. So there's a cost to it because you're buying that time factor. Like, but if you
if that buying a time factor, it could be awfully economical, really.
Well, it is, and the other thing, with you can't do it straight up, but once you've got that system running, the efficiency of your applied fertiliser, like we've reduced nitrogen usage by 20 or 30% quite easily in the second and third years, and still got better growth. So if that was saving you 100 units of N a hectare, for example, that nowadays is a lot of money, $300
or $400. Yeah. Now, Martin, when it comes to fertilisers, one of the problems we farmers have with fertilisers is that you get runoff. To me, if you get runoff with the fertiliser in waterways, not only the damages could damage the environment, but that must be expensive. How does biological, when it comes to biological farming, how would you describe the problem of runoff or no runoff with in the biological system?
Yeah, in the biological system, it's the soil algae, the microbes that keep the minerals in place and that that they can't wash away and also can't leach away into the groundwater. So it's in the soil organic matter, it's organic carbon in the soil that where all the minerals are then stored to prevent losses. And because they are stored in that sponge in the soil with the active microbes, they make it available to the plant. So that's why, like we talk about getting the same production with only a fraction of the fertilizers applied, because it's all stored more efficiently and given, provided to the plants more efficiently.
Right. Now,
can I just jump in there for a sec too?
Sure, please.
So that is, another thing we've found is that, like, working on the red source particularly, you get phosphorus tied up very quickly through the chemistry in the soil. So we found that once you get biology working in those sort of soils, you actually get a reverse of that process and you can get the phosphorus releasing out of the soils. And we've got good data coming through now that shows that, you know, the plants are getting extra phosphorus out of the soil, we're not having to apply it.
Yep.
As well as the nutrients being lost through leaching, a lot can be lost through actually just tying up through the soil chemistry. And
like 85% of the P can be locked up on the clay, and like fungi, bacteria with enzymes that loosen the P from the clay make it available then to the plant.
Do you, Kevin, you do soil tests fairly regularly. Do you find that the nutrient levels actually increase as the years go on without you putting product on, like especially like trace minerals, do you find that they, the readings on actually increase as nutrients become more available?
Yeah, well, in some cases they do. It depends whether soils are naturally deficient in those minerals. In that case, we've got to supply them to actually get the system running. But where it's a case of having them not available because they're tied up in the system, we can definitely get a response through releasing the minerals. So it depends on the individual case, really, how effectively that works. And we found, for example, on our own property, the zinc levels have risen, but the copper levels haven't. So we're naturally a low copper area, so we've got to add copper now and again, but we haven't had to add zinc for a long time.
And then when you add trace minerals, you do add them with the solution as you're spraying them out, or do you put them out in solid form?
Well, and if whichever's the most convenient, we can do it either way.
And if you're putting them out in the solution form, you'd put them out at a fraction of the quantity you would normally put out in solid form, wouldn't you?
Yes, we do, but it's usually only a fairly short-term fix too, although it depends. Like as the biological system builds, those smaller amounts become effective over a longer period too, so it's quite true that it does take less to adjust the system as it improves.
And you did mention in the farm walk that you put out 1 tonne of lime to the hectare. Most people would put out 1 tonne of lime to the acre. Can you give the listeners here a reason why you're putting out such a small amount, especially under a dairy situation?
Well, the reason is because the lime is not incorporated. It's only just spread on the surface. And so the research indicates that I've read that it infiltrates the soil system at the rate of about an inch a year. So if you put out 2.5 tonnes a hectare, the first year there's going to be an imbalance in that top part of the soil, and that can tie up phosphorus and copper and other things, and in some instances soften the soil down too much, it becomes sloppy on top. So we're not in any hurry to change the soil structure through the lining, but we are wanting to keep a constant supply of available calcium for the biology. So it's better, from my experience, to actually apply a lesser amount more often, and that saves some of that imbalance that's created by having too much on the top and then waiting for it to filter through the system. It's different if you can actually work the lime in and work it through the soil profile, but the filter's recommendation, for example, that recommends 2.5 tonnes of lime a hectare, is assuming it's going to balance 4 inches of soil, or in our case, our soil tests work on 6 inches. So you want to put that on annually for 6 years unless you're going to incorporate it into the whole profile. And Martin could probably explain how that would work better than what I can.
Yeah. First of all, the comment that Kevin made about the lesser amounts more often is better, that's critical in the biological management, because any big amount can be a shock to the living system, and that can fry microbes and set them back, etc. So in that sense, we use the Goldilocks principle. Not too little, not too much, has to be just right. And of course, the just right for each of the factors, each of the minerals and trace elements, it's different amounts. And then the lime is a classic example. Like we want smaller amounts of lime, and because the lime needs to be activated by the fungi in the soil. If we don't have fungi in the soil, if we don't have a healthy soil, then lime can't be made available to plants. So then it's only like a symptom fix for pH, but not for plant feeding. But when we have fungi in the soil, then the fungi feeds that calcium to the plants, and then the plants become stronger, the cell wall becomes thicker, so the plants become more resistant to insects and diseases, etc., and better for against lodging. So that's the issue with the smaller quantities of lime for the health of the plant, not for any soil issue.
Kevin, you said that Kevin, you said that your animals do considerably better that on the pasture than what they did in the past when they used to use a heavy NPK regime. So they're basically they're utilising their feed much better. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. And because it's more balanced, like as Martin just explained with the calcium, like we weren't putting out near enough calcium under that regime, and it wasn't getting into the plant what little we did put out. So the cell wall integrity of the plant was lacking, and it was an imbalanced sort of a plant. And the, like we know now from tests that we can do, that the metabolizable energy of that grass was much less than what it could be. So the cows were eating their fill of grass, but the energy in that grass wasn't enough to keep them in peak health or condition or in top production either. So once we remedied that and got the system back into balance, the cows were grazing less and spending more time chewing their cud and relaxing because, you know, they didn't have to eat as much grass to try and get enough energy for themselves. And things like the digestibility of the plant improve as well. So, like, even though there's a lot of funnels doing a good job with their high-input pastures, it's still very important to actually maximise the benefits that you can get from that healthy plant point of view out of the cow system. For example, I was reading an article which confirmed that just recently where they say some of these modern grasses that are pushed with the NPK, they're not buffering the cow's grain as much as they used to, so they have to introduce more of the buffering materials into the grain ration of the cows to compensate. So that to me is saying that the grass is getting to be a poorer quality feed and they're having to go to other measures to compensate and keep the cow healthy.
Now, Martin, you might like to explain that in testing, most, if not all, laboratories measure protein by a very crude method of basically measuring nitrogen rather than protein. So when you get a test of protein, is it the real thing?
Yeah. Well, that's exactly the issue with the quality of the produce that the plants, well, that the soil then gives to the plant. And like with animals grazing and with hay and any feed that comes from a healthy soil has a higher mineral density. It has more minerals because the mineral uptake is balanced and it's fed by the microbes in the soil to the plant. And the plant knows what it wants and it gets it. So with that mineral balance, the animals have to eat less to get the minerals they need. And then with nitrogen, for instance, as we apply nitrogen from the bag, the fertilizer nitrogen, and nitrogen is always taken up preferentially by the plant, so that it takes off the dominant role in uptake. And then within the plant, the proteins can't be formed because the missing links, the other elements, are not there to make a full protein, like the sulfurs, etc., and the phosphorus. So with that, and so then we have not as much good proteins, full proteins, in the produce as we need. But in our quality testing, like with the on the silos as well, with grains and with hay, whatever is tested, with the near infrared methodology, in that system, we measure the nitrogen content of produce and then multiply it with 6.5 to get the protein. So that's assuming that in all our modern farming, all the nitrogen that's measured is converted into full proteins, which is not the case. And animals know that because they have to eat more to get what they want, and even then they don't get the good proteins.
So in a sense, the farmers have been could be being misled by having us the fodder tested to be a certain amount of protein when actually it's only the nitrogen is being tested and it's a multiplication factor.
Yes, yeah.
Right.
That's definitely
Kevin,
the case, and when you take that to the extreme, if you're using cows on a nitrogen fertilised pasture without adequate grain buffering, and that you have the nitrate poisoning problem, which is because the plant is high in nitrates and not proper proteins.
But yeah, then we get to the situation also in feedlots that they feed urea with in the feedlot to get the so-called nitrogen in the system.
And do you think that's a good thing, Martin, to put the nitrogen into the system?
No, because it's all pure. Because it's all the pure synthetic fertilizers, synthetic chemicals. Everything in the biological form, like the whole proteins, is far more better because that's what the animals are used to in their metabolism. To break down and to build up from there.
Martin, is there anything that you see how we should be directing this conference call by asking Kevin any questions that would benefit the listeners?
Yeah. But there can't be questions from the outside, then?
Sorry?
Questions from listeners?
Oh, I'm not with you. Sorry, I mucked things up here, Martin. I just thought there might be something that is pressing for you that you would like to be asking Kevin to reveal what's going on in his farm or what the listeners would like to look at.
No, but like Kevin already mentioned, like some examples on other properties that he is helping managing. And then the question is how easy and how willing, how the demand is of current farming systems to want to change, Kevin? What are your experiences?
if I heard that right, it's how easy to change a system around, and it's pretty easy and straightforward, in my opinion. But I get back to what I said earlier, that the farmer has to want to do it. That's what makes it easy. Given that, the first steps that we take, for example, would be to assess the bloke's soil, see what condition it's in, and to get a good comprehensive soil test to find out what's actually got there. A lot of farmers are working from soil tests provided by fertiliser companies, which are really just designed to sell them NPK fertiliser. So we need to get a more comprehensive look at the soil than that.
That's soil test from a company that does the biological availability of minerals to the plant.
Well, that's good if you can get it. The soil tests we use just make sure they get a proper cation exchange and a proper balance, which includes the hydrogen and that sort of thing, because otherwise you're getting a biased picture of what's in the soil.
Yep.
So that's the most important thing. If you can go to the extreme of having the biological availability of the nutrients and things assessed, well, great. But if part of the approach is to introduce the biology that's going to make the nutrients more available, and you know from experience that that's what will happen, then it's not as critical as important as it might have been. Like when I was experimenting without the benefit of the biology that I've got now, I would have been more appreciative of a soil test like that. But for example, with a client that's starting out on a new farm today, we've just had an interview, and the basis of the initial soil tests are back, and they show the soil is in relatively good shape. It's got a good level of calcium, and so we just proceed from there to introduce the program to it. As what we will do in that case is apply semi-composted pig manure or chook manure or feedlot cow manure, and use that as a raw material to initiate the biological cycle. So and he'll reduce the NPK applications and concentrate more on the raw animal manures as an underlying source of nutrition for the soil, because there's a lot of organic compounds and microbes and things already in that. It's going to be a support for the biology that we're introducing. And the soil will, in the next 3 years, go through a build-up cycle when that can level off and be reduced, usually at that point.
Yeah. Kevin, you made a point of saying that you're increasing your topsoil by an inch a year. What do you think is, what process is happening in the soil to increase it to an inch a year? Like, I have heard from a reliable, so-called reliable source, that it takes 1,000 years to produce an inch of topsoil, and here you are doing it in an inch in 1 year. That sounds too good to be true. Give us a bit of, can you throw some light on that?
Well, he's probably right as well. What I'm doing is probably reintroducing a healthy topsoil into a soil that was already structurally had the potential to have at least 4 or 5 inches of good topsoil originally, which is what our soils had. But we reduced the root zone in that soil to 2 or 3 inches at the most through getting compacted. But what I do see happening is that as you get the root system down, the biology follows the roots, and you can actually see the lowest clay subsoils being converted into topsoils. In our case, at least for the first 4 or 5 inches, at the rate of about an inch a year. In the deeper red soils, that's probably true for them as well. If you went into a really shaley soil that was difficult to build a good soil into, it would probably take longer, but you'd still see the progress at the rate of maybe a quarter or half an inch. But you're actually directing and feeding the biology to do just that. So that's where the return from part of your investment in doing that comes from. You can actually build the soil. And, of course, on a bit of a tangent, one of the things that I knew you could do with this is that my wife started no-dig garden on the barest, mongrelest piece of clay just near our house originally. This was 30-something years ago, and had good topsoil there in no time. So if you left it up to nature, it might take 1,000 years, but if we help nature, we can certainly do it a lot quicker than that.
I just want to interrupt the two of you. The farmer friends who are listening, and they're listening via the computer, can they type in their questions so we can look at them and answer them? Now, Martin, a question for you is, Kevin's blessed with having reasonable rainfall down in that part of Australia. In areas where there's a lot of parts of Australia where we haven't got the rainfall and it's dry, what steps would farmers do to introduce a biological way of farming there? And is it successful, or is it for those farmers in the dry parts of Australia?
Yes, in the drier parts, you follow the same procedures. You only do it in less frequent rhythms to get the biology established. Every time you do something, you have to wait for the rain. And if it rains, you can do more. But if it doesn't rain, you just keep it the same. So then you can feed the soil with the system to be productive with the rainfall. You never overdo it. You just follow the season. And in that way, like if it stays dry, then the biology just remains in spores as in preparation for the next year. And in that whole system, especially like last year with our big drought again, following the when it stopped raining in July last year, all the farms that used the biology had higher yields than the neighbors, or the neighbors didn't have any yield. They had to strip hay of their wheat crops, etc. Because the biology conserves water. Biology makes very good use of the water that's in the soil, and that water is then used in productive ways for the plants very effectively.
So in effect, what you just said, that the biology that might go to sleep, it's there waiting to start up again, and it's not being wasted. It just the farmer benefits as soon as the moisture comes back to the soil. Would that be right?
Yes. Yeah, and that's the most amazing part that I've seen in the landscape, that as soon as it rains, like the next day, you see those paddocks greening, while neighboring paddocks take a lot longer to be green and fresh. So the system is very reactive to water, the biological active system. So when it's sleeping, it can be awoken very quickly with rain.
So in effect, I have heard in the biological process that the soil can function up to 70% less water in the soil. That's somewhat what you're saying, that you get the quicker response. It's an indication in itself, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's making more effective use of the water.
Yeah.
From my point of view, where you've got a good biology under a system, the water penetrates much easier and you get much less runoff and scouring across the surface. After a dry period, a lot of the soils that have been degraded are nearly waterproof, and most of the rainfall just runs off them and very little soaks in. It's just the opposite of where there's a good biology, much more of the water will soak in. So
yeah, because biology makes the living organisms from the microbes up to the little crazy critters and the worms is an indicator of that all the small stuff is there as well. That creates all the pores and the big worm tunnels in the soil. The aeration, more air in the soil and more infiltration of the rain. And because of the higher carbon content, more of that water is then soaked into the soil and doesn't wash away to the subsoil. So we get more plant available water in a biologically healthy soil, and it can be like up to 30 millimeters in different cases, more water available for plants to keep growing. And that's the other example that, and like last week as well, with those producers that said that the crops last year with biological treatments stayed green longer than non-biological crops.
Yeah, that is a big thing, especially in dry conditions. Now, Kevin, how far afield do you do your consulting? Because that's one thing we haven't told the listeners, that you actually not only run your own farm and your son runs a farm. I'm not too sure what you do, I know you do consulting. So how far afield do you consulting?
Well, I've just spent a couple of weeks consulting in the Atherton Tableland area, so that's 3,000 kilometres away, but I don't make a habit of doing that. But I'll go anywhere in Victoria at least if it's a worthwhile and somebody's really interested in what we're doing.
Right.
Can I use an ask concerning one
question? Now, we can unmute and have anyone asking questions online. So we'll open the calls now. Is anyone there? Well, we'll just keep going. You with me, Kevin and Martin?
Yes, yes,
yeah.
I'm still in.
Yes.
What sort of money has Kevin made this time?
One question has just come in. What sort of money has Kevin made for his clients? What's most spectacular?
Well, you should ask the clients that.
There's some idea.
That's an example of your 50% hiring productivity.
Yeah, we can go back to that one, which we catalogued. And so translating that into dollars, I remember at the time the bloke translated into about $80,000 or $100,000. And he made an investment with us of about $5,000 to do that. I should clarify that too. It was 5,000 a year for about 5 years. But his increasing productivity didn't drop either, so it's maintained, and it's another 6 years on from that now, and he's still had all those gains all that time. And a minimum of input from that stage on from our point of view.
Yeah. Martin, the one question is, it's recently we decided to try a biological approach to our farming. What would be your best piece of advice on how to start?
Yes, well, how to start is, well, the easiest way is, well, for pastures, you can start any time. Of course, it's easy to start in autumn or in spring to get some activity, to see something before the winter starts and to see activity before the active spring growth starts. That's for pastures. And for cropping, the easiest way is to start before sowing a crop. So 2 months, 3 months before sowing a crop to get things on the soil, interactive with the soil for the biology to start then with the first showers. And then you can do it like either some paddocks, like in some farmers that we talk with, they always choose or it's common to choose the worst paddock on the farm as a challenge to improve. So you can take paddocks you have questions of that you're not happy with your current management, and then start managing those paddocks biologically and see what the impact is. Other farmers that I've talked with and I've seen, they just go around, they believe in the system and they turn around the whole farm production, the farm management right from one day to the next. And in that sense, of course, you believe in the system and you work very hard to make it working. While if you have one or two paddocks, could always be some other activity that prevents you doing the right thing for those two paddocks, three.
Now, another question is, what are the, Martin or Kevin, or both of you can answer this one, what are the top three strategies that work the best if you are a farmer trying to survive this drought?
Well, this drought, survive this drought and the high price of fertilizers. And the high price of fertilizers is more of a challenge, and there's more demand now for this biological thinking because of the price rather than the drought. So the first step is for the biology to be activated. What were the three steps again that you asked for?
No, it says the customer's asking, or the farmer's asking, what are the top three strategies that would What are the top three strategies that work the best if you are a farmer trying to survive this drought?
Yeah. Well, the first one is to never overdo it in terms of inputs, and because that's inputs from the bag the way we are now, and that's such a high risk these days that it becomes very difficult to run them. So we go to biological ways, and every biological ways, like for for $20 a hectare, $25 a hectare, where we can introduce a biological active spray over the paddock, either pasture or a crop, to activate biology and to stimulate the soil fertility through the biological processes. And once we start using those small steps and we see the impact of those small steps, we can then continue to go. And the advantage, again, what I said before, with any drought conditions, is that if we do it with the biology, it's far easier to dose the rates in proper ways than with things from the bag and the drum.
Kevin, you say your piece.
I'm focusing more on the business side of it, because everything Martin said is very true. And the biggest thing to do to maintain or to survive a drought is to bring your focus back onto the core business. And one aspect of your core business is to actually maintain as much ground cover and as you can on your property. So that means keep from overgrazing fragile areas and concentrate stock into areas that you're going to keep on the place and feed. Concentrate them into areas that aren't fragile ecosystems and that can be easily rehabilitated after the drought. And there, in that sense, you're preserving the plant and the biology on your more fragile areas, so that it's in line with what Martin's saying, you're preserving that biological aspect of the system. And droughts are a good, because of the stress and the difficulty in a drought situation, people are a lot more open to change sometimes then, and so it's a good opportunity to look at, well, what are you going to do when it does rain? And are you going to do more of the same thing as you were doing in the past, or are you going to take this as an opportunity to take a more biological approach? And, that can often be a time where you can make a lot of progress in a different direction without the high input cost of the fertilisers.
Yeah, I suppose the bottom line is...
That's a good point about the drought business that Kevin now talked about with animals stocking. Like, I've seen examples now of farmers getting rid of a stud, which was a family close to heart, etc. But if the property is not big enough, then you do harm to the soil all the time. When you get rid of the stud, then you have, and in general, you get rid of high stocking rates, or you decrease it more than what you would want, then we can alleviate the pressure on the land and the plants. If it starts raining, we can keep locking out the animals to have the plants starting growing. And then with those growing plants, we get more roots growing into the soil. And those plants pump carbon in the soil, which feed the biology in the soil to make the biology active. So that's the way for high production in drought conditions.
So in effect, taking a biological approach to farming lessens the bad effect of a drought. Would you say that be the case, Martin and Kevin?
Yes. Yeah.
Definitely. Like the drought we just had like a year or so back here, all of our dairy farms kept green pastures alive through the drought the whole time. They didn't grow much, but they didn't die off either. So the advantage for them was, as soon as there was a shower or two of rain, there was something there to respond. And it was a noticeable difference between those properties and the other properties in the area.
Yeah, that is saying something. Now, Kevin, I've got a question here which you partially answered, but we haven't answered it specifically, is farmer friend has got 80 hectares of pasture and 100 hectares of cropping. What sort of rates would he use the Petrick products, and what would it cost him to do the pasture and the cropping? I suppose to ask is you'd have to look at the soil status, wouldn't you, before you could answer that question?
Well, you would from the point of view of what other inputs are required, but from the Petrick materials point of view, the most effective combination of the Petrick material for pastures is what we've already talked about, and that's...
That was about $50 a hectare.
Around $50, yeah, and so for 80 hectares, you're looking at, what, $4,000? So $3,500 to $4,000. The cropping is more complex. The crop that I work with only treats seed at the moment, so a seed treatment works out at about $13 a hectare. So for 100 hectares, that's $1,300. But if you add biology to that, well, then you can increase that that's another $10 to $40 a hectare, depending on what you actually do to support the biology. But I could take that opportunity to go back to that question where what productivity did we increase, because I've just looked at a cropping trial where that seed treatment and biology was applied to a sorghum crop last season in the Liverpool Plains area of mid-New South Wales, and that got an increase of 3 tonnes per hectare over the untreated area. And at the time, I think the sorghum was worth about $300 a tonne. So for about $30 a hectare investment, that guy got nearly $1,000 back.
Now, Martin, in your work with the cereals in Australia, did you notice that, or did you observe that farmers who are farming biologically were actually more productive or increased their net profits?
Yeah, certainly. Well, like production can stay the same, like the yields can be the same as the neighbours, but that gross margin increases because the inputs cost less. And that's especially now, this year, the case, because with the high fertilizer prices.
Right, so it's going to be more pronounced this year, isn't it?
Yeah. Because we have the biology is then helping feeding the plant, and it makes the soil structure better, the infiltration becomes better, so we get the whole resource use for crops more effective.
Okay. One of the reasons with introducing, like particularly our petric biology, for example, into a soil, and doing the supporting processes open up the soil so that air can actually circulate through the soil, well, that air is 80% nearly nitrogen. And if you've got the biology in the soil that can fix some of that nitrogen, that's where the nitrogen efficiency comes from. There's a particular colonies of microbes that can actually fix the nitrogen that's in the atmosphere and supply that to the plant through the root system. So,
Martin and Kevin, the time's nearly up. Kevin, would you like to sort of sum up, and what's your message for the farmers?
Was that for me?
Yes, Kevin.
My message is to be open to change. And if you're considering change, look around for people in the local area that are changing and see what works. There's just as many crooks in farming consultancies as there is in any other business. So the main thing I say to farmers is, like, you don't have to jump into the fire or, you know, from the frying pan into the fire, so to speak. You can look at what you're considering doing. Usually there's somebody doing it not too far away, and go and talk to them and see what their experience with it is and how long it's worked for them. That's a critical thing too. There's a lot of short-term fixes that can use up a fair bit of money, and that was my experience. So get to somebody that's actually doing the things you're considering doing and see how they're working for them. Or if a consultant turns up on your doorstep with a U-Butte idea for you to try, ask him what success he's had in the past, and can you go and see some of that for yourself and talk to the guys doing it. And
Can I keep talking?
I think that's about the best takeaway message I could give anyway. And
that's great, Kevin. Now, Martin, have you got a message for the farmers?
Yeah, well, like biological farming, it's not recipe farming. It's not a fixed rate and fixed products that you can apply for high yields, for high productivity. Each condition, because it's biology, it's dependent on the biology and the climate, two complex factors in our world. Because it's so dependent, we have to mix different inputs, different stimulants for the biology in different amounts for different situations. And, of course, in that building knowledge to know what in your area, your soil types, your crops and pastures, what best works, it's a matter of being together in a group, learning from each other and helping each other to get that knowledge quantified for your district. And every district here in Australia has farmers that are going in that direction, so more and more of that support becomes available.
So, Martin, the last question. Would you agree with me that biological farming is not necessarily a complicated way of farming, and there's easy steps that farmers can put into place?
Yes. Yeah, look, it's not like what I said before about it's not recipe farming, and you need different inputs, different amounts, different times. But there's no fixed way in those mixes. Like, it's just a global search for answers, and it's not very direct to minute detail because the biology will fix itself. It's just to get the global directions right, and as you are working them together, you get better in that assessment. It's all based on intuition and energies to feel those in the surrounding to get a judgment on what's right and what's not right.
Martin and Kevin, is there anything else you'd like to say to finish up? Because I'm going to hand the phone over to Helen to wind up.
My finishing comment is to just simply say that what Martin had just said is 100% right. Biological farming is not difficult or complex. It's really very simple, but it's intuitive based, and you need to have the will to succeed at it. That's what brings the intuition and the resourcefulness into it.
I liked it when you said, Kevin, when you said look at other farmers, because that's virtually like having a mentor, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to pass it over to Helen now.
Oh, hello, Martin and Kevin. We'd like to thank you both very, very much for spending your time with us tonight, because both of you, along with Farming Secrets, are dedicated to farmers succeeding and returning full life to the soils. And I really think we're privileged to have had both of you sharing your knowledge with us all tonight, and like to say good night now and thank you very much. So it's good night from Farming Secret.
Yeah. Okay, Helen, you go.
Thank you very much.
And Kevin, thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Kevin, bye.
The moderator has disconnected. The call will now end.